We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it? I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
Hey, everybody. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode 107. It's going to go up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, eVooks, YouTube, on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com, and libertarianinstitute.org in the blog section. I want to remind you about my book, The Kids Are Not All Right, a meme-enhanced primer on encroaching Marxism in the West. It is available on Amazon. Some people have asked how they can monetarily support the show. I'm not taking any donations or anything like that. Anybody who buys the book, that money goes towards the show, goes towards equipment, and goes towards, you know, anything I need to get this thing done. So buy the book, read it, hand it out. It's good information. Get the information out there. Today, I am welcoming Gareth Porter. Gareth is an investigative historian and journalist. He covers the national security state, and he authored the book Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. He released that in 2014. In 2012, Gareth was awarded the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism. It's an award that's given annually by the Frontline Club in London to acknowledge reporting that exposes official propaganda. For a series of articles Gareth did on U.S. policies in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Today, I'm going to ask Gareth some questions about the Iran deal of 2015 and about Netanyahu's claim this week that Iran is violating the deal and that they have evidence that Iran is building nukes. So how are you doing today, Gareth?
I'm fine, thanks. Very busy, as always, but... You know, we're okay this morning.
All right then. I have some questions. Want to talk about the Iran deal? Talk about what happened with Netanyahu this week. So, first question is: this past Monday, Netanyahu did a PowerPoint in which he laid out the argument that Iran is not abiding by the terms of the nuclear deal that was done in 2015. Can you give us an overview of what was expected? What's expected of the parties in this deal?
Well, this is basically a bargain between Iran on one side and the coalition of states who negotiated with it, led, by, of course, by the United States, by the Obama administration, but also including the EU3, Russia, and China. And essentially, the bargain was that Iran would agree to curb its nuclear program very dramatically, put off the objective that it had set for itself of an industrial power program, a power program to serve for Iranian industry for many years, and to basically forego a lot of the research that it had planned to do, and of course to end essentially the program of uranium enrichment that it had been carrying out for a number of years. And in return, what the Iranians got from the United States was the agreement that the U.S. would end the sanctions that had been imposed on Iran on account of its alleged Iranian nuclear weapons program, and I say alleged very deliberately, as I'm sure you understand why, and also not impose new sanctions that are related in any way to the nuclear issue. That's a simplified version, but that is essentially the bargain that sustained the negotiations and which resulted in the agreement that is now obviously in grave danger.
Okay, I was going to ask you the question of whether, you know, what the evidence points to is Iran abiding by the terms of this deal, but I think it's just easiest to jump into the PowerPoint presentation that Netanyahu made this past Monday saying that Iran wasn't. And you wrote an article that was published in consortiumnews.com. It was published this past Thursday. And you claim that there were a lot of falsehoods in Netanyahu's presentation. So can you talk about what you heard in Netanyahu's presentation and what doesn't add up?
Sure. Well, first of all, it should be clarified that what Netanyahu was arguing was not merely that Iran was violating the agreement. In fact, what he has what he was saying in his presentation, 20-minute, rather theatrical, very theatrical presentation, which was not just PowerPoint but slides with photographs and charts and so forth. What he was arguing was that Iran had lied from the beginning to the end that it had never had a nuclear weapons program. He was trying to make the case that the Israeli government, the Israeli intelligence, had now basically stolen out from under the noses, if you will, of the Iranian government in Tehran itself, half a ton of documents which supposedly were the basically the atomic archives, is what he called them, of the covert Iranian nuclear weapons program. And what I was pointing out in my article and essentially detailing is that, in the first place, the entire notion that the Israeli intelligence and or military commandos had gone into Tehran and seized half a ton of secret documents on this supposed nuclear weapons program is so totally implausible as to be quite laughable. I mean, the whole idea was astonishingly obviously untrue that it is just startlingly stupid that the U.S. news media, the world's news media, failed to exhibit the slightest bit of curiosity about whether this could possibly be true. And I give various reasons in my article that as to why it is simply not plausible that this happened. I mean, just to begin with, the whole idea that the documents had been stored, he didn't say this, but officials of the Israeli government pointed out to some news outlets that or claimed to news outlets that the reason the Iranian government had moved these papers to this tin-roofed small hut in Tehran, totally unguarded, no security in evidence at all, is that they had been put in the military bases of Iran, the military was afraid that IAEA inspectors would come into the base and find these documents, and so they moved them to this secret location, quote-unquote, in Tehran, without any sign of any security. So I just want to underline just how totally unbelievable that whole story that Netanyahu told in his performance really was. So to go to the evidence specifically about whether there was ever an Iranian nuclear weapons program or not, I would point to three specific pieces of evidence that Netanyahu focused on in his slideshow, which have to do with three documents that are not documents that he suddenly discovered in Tehran, but documents which were turned over to the International Atomic Energy Agency by the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, more than 15 years ago, or about 15 years ago now, and which these documents were actually supposedly coming from the laptop computer of an Iranian who was involved in this alleged underground nuclear weapons program. But I was able to show in my book and in various articles that I've written on this that, and based on a senior German foreign office official, former German foreign office official, who gave me an on-the-record interview explaining how those documents did not come from an Iranian scientist, but came from a sometime source of the German intelligence agency who they knew to be a member of the Mujahideen Khalq. Now, I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with the Mujahideen Khalq, the MEK, but it's a former armed opposition Iranian organization which the State Department had on its list of terrorist organizations for many years, and which by the time these documents were surfacing in 2004, was working hand-in-hand, hand-in-glove, if you will, with the Israeli Mossad Foreign Intelligence Organization. They were laundering intelligence or laundering information that Mossad did not want to have attributed to itself or to Israel, giving it then to the IAEA or to foreign governments and making it look like this was coming from inside Iran. So that's the first point that we need to keep in mind about these alleged documents. And then secondly, each of the three documents that he features in this presentation, I was able to show, based on very careful analysis of what the IAEA had published about these documents, very specific information that they published describing them, on one hand, and other verifiable information that was coming from either the IAEA itself or from independent experts on the Iranian ballistic missile program, to show that these were documents that could not have been authentic. They were fabricated documents. And the evidence in each case had to do with contradictions between information that's shown in the document and information that comes from either the IAEA itself or from this other independent source. For example, I'll give you the specific example that I think is most important. The biggest news about a set of documents that came out in 2004 that was made public, or the re-existence of which was made public in 2004 originally, was the allegation that Iran was trying to put come up with a plan to put a nuclear weapon on the Shahab 3 intermediate range missile, which was their main missile at that moment, as far as the world knew, as far as the outside world knew. So there were a series of drawings which were supposedly an effort to mate a nuclear weapon with this Shahab 3 missile. And what the drawing showed was a schematic drawing of the nose cone, the reentry vehicle of the Shahab 3, and then had a circle in it where the bomb would go. It was rather crude drawing, actually. And Netanyahu actually showed this in his showed the schematic in his presentation. Well, what I was able to show in my analysis of it in my book was that this could not have been a drawing that was done by the Iranian government's missile program, or by some secret group of scientists designing a nuclear weapon, or planning to design a nuclear weapon. It had to come from outside the Iranian government, because the missile reentry vehicle that was shown was the wrong design. It was a design that had been thrown out by the Iranian government at least 2.5 years before these drawings were supposedly drawn, according to the information that was given by the IAEA. So it was an absolutely open and shut case that these drawings could not have been authentic. They could not have come from the Iranian government. They came from some foreign organization. And of course, I think the evidence that it was Israel's Mossad is very, very powerful. So that's the first one. There are two other cases that I talk about in my article in some depth, and we can go into them if you have time, if you want to.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Okay, so if you have time, we'll do that. The second document was one that showed a bench experiment or process for the conversion of uranium so that it can be enriched. It was a small scale flow sheet for a small-scale approach to the conversion of uranium. And he did not show that actual document. He referred to it very clearly in his talk. And this was supposed to be evidence that that part of the secret Iranian nuclear weapons program was that they had this this design for an approach to or a flow chart for an approach to this new way of converting uranium for a nuclear weapon, making the uranium that would be used for a nuclear weapon. Now, the problem with that one was that this was said to be part of something called Project 5. It was a sub-project given the number 5.13. This is according to the IAEA documentation on this specific study. And another element of that Project 5, which was given the sub-project name 5.15, was a ore mining project at Gashin mine in Iran, and it was a rather strange addition to what was supposed to be a secret nuclear weapons project to have a mining project. And some observers who'd read the documents or who'd talked to people who read the documents thought that was very curious, to say the least. And in my book, I point out that the 5.15 ore mining project shows that this could not have been a genuine document, a genuine Iranian document. It had to come, again, from somebody outside who was simply not, who was not part of that supposed Iranian project. And the reason is that the date, first of all, there was a Gashin mine project, and it was called 5.15. It was given a code name 5.15, but it was not part of a secret nuclear weapons project. It was an open, openly given contract to an Iranian contracting company, which was, the contract was given 2.5 years before the date of this alleged project, the earliest date of this alleged project. So it again gives away the fact that this was not a genuine document. It was a fabricated document, and again, I point to Mossad as the party that had both the capability and the strong motivation to carry out that kind of fabrication. Then the third one that they allude to is something called IMP. It's a project that had to do with it was a technology that was used to set off a nuclear weapon. And according to the documents that the Israelis were claiming they captured, and a document that we know the IAEA had, this was something that came into the IAEA long after the other documents, we call the laptop documents, were given to the IAEA. And the giveaway in this case, this goes back to the fact that these were actually turned over to the IAEA by the Israeli government itself. This did not come from Iran. It did not come from any organization that was supposedly Iranian. It came directly from the Israeli government, given to the IAEA in 2008. And how do we know this? We know this because Mohammad El-Baradei, the former director general of the IAEA, talks about the fact that Israel turned over a whole new set of documents to the IAEA in 2008-2009, two waves of documents during that period. And we know that the IAEA did not obtain these documents until 2008. The other documents, remember, came to them much earlier in 2005, turned over by the Bush administration. So this is, again, a giveaway that this document was not an authentic Iranian document. It came from the Israelis. So I use these three cases, the three major cases that Netanyahu talks about. And, of course, again, he claims that he got the documents, that the Israeli government got these documents from this supposed raid on Tehran right out from under the Iranians' noses, capturing a half a ton of atomic archive documents. We know that that was not the case.
Well, I wanted to ask you a question to leave all. I mean, that was amazing. I mean, that just stops what Netanyahu was talking about in his tracks. You know, unfortunately, as we know, most people are going to look at that and it being reported on the quote unquote mainstream news, they'll take it as gospel. So, you know, that's
I'm
why
sorry
we
to
need
say
to get.
You're absolutely right about that. Yeah.
So that's why we try to get your message out there to, you know, shed light on what the truth is and especially to point out the falsehoods. But I had somebody ask me, they wanted to ask you a question. And yeah. I think this is a question that a lot of us have and most people don't have a good answer for it. It's historically, what is the cause of this tension between Israel and Iran?
Ah, that's a good question. Yeah, it's an important question, and you're right. People are completely uninformed about this. There's very little information about it. In fact, I did a very long article on precisely this subject in the Journal of Palestine Studies, it was autumn 2015 issue of the Journal of Palestine Studies, and it's about, my article is about how Israel constructed the idea of Iran as an existential threat to Israel starting in the early 1990s. And I can give you a very quick summary or summation of the origins of this idea, and it has evolved over time, but it began with a labor government in power in 1993, which was interested not so much in Iran, it was not concerned about Iran so much as about what to do about the PLO. And the government at that time was determined to negotiate with the PLO. The view at that point was that the PLO, that what Israel needed to enhance its security was to make a deal with the PLO. And that was not a popular notion. It was not a popular idea in Israeli society and politics at that point. And so Prime Minister Rabin, who was the Prime Minister at that time in the Labor government, decided to come up with a rationale for negotiating with the PLO that essentially drew on the notion that there's a bigger, much more dangerous, longer-term enemy threat to Israel that we must prepare for by uniting people within Israel, and that means coming to an agreement with the PLO, and the enemy, of course, was Iran. It couldn't be Iraq at that point, or it would not work so well because Iraq in 1993 was flat on its back, had been defeated by the United States, was a shadow of its former self, did not have any real power with which to threaten Israel. But Iran was much more independent, was still, in a position that Israel could claim that Iran was a future threat to Israel. And that's exactly how that whole idea began. It was not because the Israeli military or intelligence organizations really believed that Iran was threatening Israel or that any time in the near future there was going to be any threat to Israel. It was a political ploy to justify what Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin believed was necessary to enhance Israeli security by negotiating with the PLO.
Wow. So and right about then, or a couple years later, we started getting all the Iran is 5 years away from having a nuclear weapon.
That's right.
Announcements.
That's exactly right. That's precisely the point. You begin to see these stories appearing in the Israeli press and in the American press, by the way, as well, about the threat of a future Iranian bomb, how close they are, and so on and so forth. In Israeli press, it was much more, it was much more far-fetched. They were talking about, could be a bomb within a very short time. That was not being said in the United States, but they were beginning to talk about the possibility that Iran was moving towards a nuclear weapon, even in the U.S. in the U.S. press, based on people within the U.S. government who were taking that line. Later on, of course, when Iran began to acquire ballistic missiles, then the argument in Israel and in the United States began to shift towards the problem of missiles, and then missiles combined with nuclear weapons. So you can see the logic of how that began to unfold. But bear in mind that in the 1990s, under the Labor government, they began to talk about the idea that if Iran did not give up its nuclear program, that Israel might attack Iran's nuclear sites, attack Iran. And so that's the reason that the Iranians began to acquire ballistic missiles as a deterrent, because they didn't have any air force. They had to go for ballistic missiles as a way of trying to deter the Israelis from attacking them.
Oh. Well, I know you're really busy, so I'm going to ask you one more question, and maybe this one might take a pretty long answer, might require a long answer as well. So,
no problem.
Why does it seem that the U.S. seems to back any play that Israel does unquestioningly?
Well, actually, there can be a very long answer, or there can be a short answer to that, and we can go somewhere in between, perhaps. The short answer is that the Israelis have penetrated the political system of the United States so thoroughly, basically beginning in, I would argue, in the early 1990s. I think that there's a coincidence here between the degree to which the pro-Israeli right, the Israeli lobby, if you will, achieved a position within Congress where it could mobilize majorities in favor of whatever law or resolution the lobby wished to foist on the Congress or on the American people. And it was because of that, in fact, because of that reality, that for the first time the United States took extremely harsh economic sanctions against Iran. They cut off trade during the Clinton administration. The United States totally cut off all trade with Iran for the first time. And that was because of the Israeli lobby having such a powerful position within Congress. And, of course, then more recently, you get a phenomenon of big, basically Zionist, ultra-Zionist donors who play such a key role in presidential election campaigns through their funding. That has been the case in both of the past two presidential election campaigns. Adelson was, casino magnate, Sheldon Adelson, who donated, I've forgotten the exact amount now, tens of millions of dollars to the campaign against Obama in 2012, and then donated a huge amount, I think $30 million. I'm not sure about that amount at this moment, to Trump's campaign in 2016. So that has become the combination of those two elements of the Zionist penetration of the U.S. political system, I think, really tilts the balance so dramatically compared with previous periods in American history, obviously, that it does account for the largest part of the U.S. tilt towards Israeli interests in the Middle East.
Now, one more question. I've seen lists of, you talk about infiltrating Congress specifically. Yeah. I've seen lists of elected officials, lawmakers that have actually carry dual citizenship between Israel and the United States. Is this a conspiracy theory or is this a fact?
Actually, that is a conspiracy theory. I mean, it is simply not true that there are many, many political figures, including members of Congress, who are citizens of the United States and Israel. I have seen that myself. I've seen lists that have been put forward, and there is absolutely no evidence to support them.
Excellent. Well, thank you for clearing that up, because sure. There's enough fact out there to work with that we don't need any falsehoods getting in the way or can be actually hurled our way to when we make the argument that this is not in our best interest.
Absolutely, and I'm really glad that you asked that question. I think it's an important thing to clarify.
Okay. Well, I'm all out of questions. I just wanted to bring up your book is Manufactured Crisis: The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. You released that in 2014, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, and it's it represents the work of I started working on the Iran nuclear issue around 2007. So it's about a 7-year work. I mean, it's obviously I was doing other things during that time, but I was collecting information throughout the 7 years and with a lot of interviews with people in the U.S. intelligence community, former, but people who had been in the U.S. intelligence community, including the guy who was in charge of the 2007 National Intelligence Estimate, Tom Finger, a senior official at the CIA until he retired. So there's a lot of original material that you cannot find anywhere else. Nobody else has done this work, and so I hope your listeners will seriously consider taking a look at that book.
I encourage anyone who has any wants to look at this in depth to pick up that book. It's Manufactured Crisis: The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. It was released in 2014. It's Gareth Porter, and it's on Amazon, correct?
That's right, yeah. It's advertised on Amazon. Yeah.
I want to thank you for your time today. I want to thank you for the amazing work you're doing. And I know you've been doing this work your whole life. I've heard you talk on the Tom Woods show about work that you were doing during the Vietnam War.
Well, I have been working in one way or another on these kinds of issues, but I've only been a journalist, investigative journalist, actually, since 2005. That's a longer story I won't go into, but I have a lot of experience on U.S. wars, starting with Iran, with Vietnam. And I was a journalist in Vietnam for 1 year, but then I took a long, long hiatus before I took it up again.
Well, I want to thank you for the work you do, and I'm sure my listeners want to thank you too. So keep it up. I know you're busy. Have a great day.
Thanks so much, Vance. Enjoy being on your show.
Thank you. All right, people, that's it. I want to thank you for tuning in. Remind you about my book, The Kids Are Not All Right. Check it out on Amazon. I'll be back at you midweek with another podcast. So take care. Have a great week. Bye.